Good morning, and may it please the Court. This case should be remanded to the immigration judge because in the course of denying Mr. Bongiorno's request for deferral of removal, the agency committed two errors. First, they applied an incorrect legal standard for determining governmental acquiescence in torture. And second, more broadly, they've arrived at the decision unsupported by substantial evidence. Going to the first issue of the proper legal standard, the history of the standard at the board level is instructive here. The board back in 2000 first determined that governmental acquiescence has to be more than willful blindness. It has to be willful acceptance. It has to be actual approval. It cannot be mere willful blindness. And every circuit court that has addressed that question has disagreed with the board. Most notably, I guess, in Zheng, the Ninth Circuit decision, the court said to so narrowly construe the regulation talking about governmental acquiescence, and this is the quote, would be misconstruing and ignoring the clear congressional intent that governmental awareness include both actual knowledge and willful blindness. And all the circuit courts that have considered this issue agree with the Ninth Circuit on that. This court has not yet addressed this issue. It, in Patel decision, an unpublished decision, it used the language turned blind eye, which is similar formulation to willful blindness, but it has not yet had a chance to address this issue. But as we noted in our reply, the board does apply now willful blindness standard even in decisions that arise out of Florida, so the 11th Circuit precedent, which likewise does not address this issue, and in the case coming out of Chicago, in a different decision, they applied this willful blindness standard.
How would that standard apply, you know, to a case where a government was simply ineffective? I understand that's not your argument here, but I'm wondering about other countries where a national government is simply unable to protect its citizens from private harm.
Under the willful blindness standard, Your Honor, it would meet the willful blindness standard. So our position is that if the government is unable to control, that's in effect the government choosing to look another way. I mean, we call it taking the ostrich approach. I mean, they're digging in and they're not paying attention to this problem. They're not able to control it, but that to us would be willful blindness. It's them looking another way. Under the willful acceptance standard that the board applied previously and all the circuits rejected, that would not be enough. Mm-hmm. You would have to show. I'm sorry.
The government could be fully aware of what's going on and simply be unable. It's not that they don't want to know about it. They know about it and simply do not have the resources to protect people in certain provinces of Afghanistan or some years ago in certain parts of Colombia and so on.
Sure.
Let me just ask you a couple of elementary questions before we go any further. Is plaintiff in custody or petitioner in custody now?
He is.
And if he is granted a deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, would he remain in custody?
He would not remain in custody, Your Honor. He is in custody right now solely because of the immigration removal proceedings. So he would not remain. If the question is, would he be still subject to the state court sentence that was imposed against him?
That's long, long since passed, right?
Right. Okay. I wasn't sure if that's where you're going, Judge Hamilton. But with respect to his...
I thought it was possible for him to remain in custody if it was a deferral situation at the instigation of the immigration authorities, not related at all to any kind of state court proceedings or anything. Is that incorrect?
I think it would be incorrect, Judge, simply because there will be a final order of removal outstanding against him, but the order would be deferred until...
Well, that's the point. I mean,
right.
Suppose the government thought that he was a flight risk or he was going to try to sink below the surface of everybody's awareness. And it seems since he remains under the removal order and it's only deferred because of the CAT's provisions, that's a rather unusual circumstance. It doesn't fit the usual model of asylum or cancellation or the other kinds of remedies.
You know, perhaps if the government demonstrates and argues that he is a flight risk or there is some unique circumstances that would justify holding him, I suspect that is possible. I don't know the answer to that question definitively.
It sounds kind of important here. because I would have thought, because, for example, in I know there's been some debate. It's not legally relevant right now, but some debate about how serious the criminal record is in this case. But we can certainly imagine cases in which somebody who poses a far greater danger to U.S. society nevertheless qualifies for non-discretionary withhold or deferral of removal because of the clear threat of torture. And I wouldn't think that such a person has to be, that the choice is not between returning them to torture and letting them roam the United States freely.
Mm. I think in those cases, Your Honor, it's possible, too, that the state court sentence would be much larger, of course, than it is in our case.
Well, but actually, the Supreme Court has said that the immigration authorities can hold people practically indefinitely who, for whatever reason, can't be removed, and there are all sorts of reasons. Sometimes you just can't get the receiving country to agree. Some political boundaries have changed. So I think that this is probably resolvable, that he can be kept in custody, 8 CFR 1208.17, until he can be safely removed to someplace. I want to ask you a different question, which is, how you reconcile yourself the fact that the immigration judge eventually, after the remand, finds Mr. Wanjiru to be credible and yet draws the inference that he's not met the standards that the CAT imposes for showing that he's likely to be tortured or put to death if sent back to Kenya? How far do we have to defer to that bottom line conclusion?
I think you look at the underlying reasoning, and I see I'm into my rebuttal time, but if I can address the question, Judge Wood. If you look at the different parts of the immigration judge's reasoning here, so for example, on the question of identification as a defector by the Mungiki, the immigration judge says, I have doubts. That, under this circuit's precedent in Kenya, would not be enough. So you don't have to defer to that because it's not a clear reason that tells you the immigration judge would have denied deferral of removal solely because of that. Now, as to the parts where the immigration judge actually gave you some reasoning, we explain this fully in the brief, but for example, would he be killed by the Mungiki, assuming they identify him? The immigration judge sidesteps certain evidence. And, for example, when he describes the oath that the recruits give, he talks about it as they agree to die if they divulge the secrets. That's not the case. The oath that's in the record is, from today I have joined the Mungiki movement, and if I come out of Mungiki, I have agreed to die. So the immigration judge cannot simply put that to a side and call the oath something that what it's not in the record. So he did find Mr. Wanjiru credible, and the immigration judge and then the BIA made a mistake in how they analyzed the evidence, which is why our position is that it's not supported by substantial evidence. I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Carmichael?
So before you start, Ms. Carmichael, I see you're shuffling your papers. Can you either confirm or deny that this regulation I mentioned, 1208.17, would permit the government to keep him in custody if he's under a deferral?
Yes, Your Honor. 1208.17 does permit the petitioner to remain in custody where he's granted deferral of removal, and that is primarily because deferral of removal does not confer status. Rather, it prohibits the petitioner from being removed to the country where it's deemed that there's a likelihood he will be tortured. Deferral of removal can be terminated by instituting new proceedings based on the DHS's belief that the petitioner no longer has a likelihood of being tortured. Also, deferral of removal may be terminated based on diplomatic representations that the petitioner will not be tortured if he's removed to that country. Also, deferral of removal permits DHS to remove him to a safe third country where there's not a likelihood of torture.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
All right. May it please the Court, Amy Carmichael for the government. First, I want to address the Board's definition of and meaning of acquiescence as applied in this case. First of all, the controlling board's case law is a matter of SV. The board in this case does not specifically say that they used the willful acceptance standard, but rather cite to matter of YL, which which references matter of SV. Now, the really important difference between the willful blindness approach as taken by the Ninth Circuit and the matter of SV decision is that the question is primarily whether that government's actions need to be effective. In matter of SV, the board found that they acknowledged that willful blindness is the standard, but then went on to explain how that standard must be met. The board doesn't require actual knowledge, but rather requires that, consistent with the regulation, the government must be aware of the torture and silently or passively accept it.
Doesn't that include the latter? I mean, I can remember all sorts of immigration cases where when we're looking for what I might call state action or government action, it's either that the government is doing it or the government is unwilling or unable to prevent the persecutory or torture or whatever action.
The unwilling or unable is the standard that's used for asylum, but this is a slightly different standard. Here, what the board has found is that the government has to be aware of the torture and they have to fail in their duty to intervene.
So doesn't the State Department report about the Mungiki provide tremendously powerful evidence that the Kenyan government is aware of the activities of this group?
And the Kenyan government is intervening.
The question is failing to intervene in many instances.
Well, I mean, the question is how effective that intervention is. And in this case...
What about Mr. Wanjiru's cousin? I mean, it seems not too effectively in his own personal family.
Well, the question of effectiveness is it's never whether the government is able to stop every single instance of criminal activity. It's always whether the government is responsive to the criminal activity and is making general attempts to stop the criminal activity.
But notice that we actually have two things slightly in tension with each other. Even if that's true, there's also the necessity to show that the petitioner in particular is at risk of whatever it is, you know, torture or death in this case. And as a member, as a former member, if you will, of the Mungiki, or perhaps a perpetual member of the Mungiki, according to this oath in the record, and as somebody whose own family has been targeted by the Mungiki, and as somebody who went to a lot of meetings, why doesn't Mr. Wanjiru fall in that specific category?
Okay. There's a few things. First of all, the petitioner testified that he kept his membership a secret. He was unable to provide
to his family, but he was in lots of meetings. There were plenty of people who saw him, he said.
Right, but he was unable to name any of those people.
He was unwilling to name. He doesn't quite say he's unable.
He testified that he couldn't remember anybody's name.
Well, but he also says, let me find this right here, because he says... Something like I knew their names, but I didn't want to specify. That's in the record. So this is on redirect when he's asked why he's not giving people's names. And so it seems when he says I cannot specify their names, he means because I'll be killed. You know, it doesn't mean that they're not in his brain somewhere.
I think while that might be a reasonable inference of the record, it's also a reasonable inference that he just doesn't know who any of these people are. He also testified...
That's not quite what he says. He couldn't really recall their names, not all of them. Why can't you remember more names? Like, I knew their names, but I didn't want to specify. That's consistent with somebody who's really afraid of the group.
The petitioner in this case also... However, testified that he didn't know anything about the Mungiki's activities. He didn't know that the Mungiki was a violent criminal organization.
Well, he was very young when he was first recruited, right? He's 14 after this ceremony.
Yes, but he was 20 when he left, and he testified that he was collecting money for businesses.
He's kind of a bag man for them, it sounds like.
He didn't know anything about what the money was used for. He wasn't able to identify any of the general goals of the group. And the question isn't whether this panel would have come to a different conclusion. The record is whether the record compels the conclusion and whether the immigration judge could not have come to the conclusion that he came to.
Well, I thought the question really was whether the immigration judge built a sufficient bridge between the evidence and the findings he made. And the ultimate conclusion. Could I take you back for a moment, Ms. Carmichael, to this question of, that you told Judge Wood about concerning government action and this acquiescence or blindness? I think you were suggesting that there's a difference between the standard that applies when we're considering a timely, proper petition for asylum and under the Convention Against Torture. I guess, could you describe for me a case that would satisfy the asylum standard but would not satisfy the Convention Against Torture standard to illustrate what you think is the difference?
Okay. I think the major difference is that under the asylum rule, the question is whether the government's able to offer sufficient protection, and the unable to intervene is going to question the effectiveness. But here, the government has to have really to a certain extent, either a hand in the actual torture, or they have to be completely ignoring it. What the regulation says is that they have a legal obligation to intervene, and they fail to do so.
Okay, so this would apply then, and I'm just...
For example, like a drug cartel in Colombia, the government's unable to control the cartel, but that doesn't mean that the government's necessarily ignoring what cartel is doing.
So we interpret the Convention Against Torture as authorizing the removal of people to countries where we know they will be tortured or killed by private actors that governments cannot control. So we send people back to Somalia or to parts of Afghanistan where order has simply broken down. Is that what the Convention Against Torture really means?
Well, what the board has said is really that the government, the government has to be making an effort. If the government isn't making any sort of effort, then that would meet the standard for convention protection. But here, the government's clearly making quite an effort to stop the activities of the Mangiki. It's just a question of effectiveness. But again,
but when you say just a question of effectiveness, that does take you to Judge Hamilton's question. You know, if they're making an effort, but the group in question, whether it's FARC, whether it's the Colombian drug cartels, whether it's the Mangiki, is so powerful that the effort is ineffective for a great number of people, you know, kind of a pathetic effort, that it seems against the purpose of the Convention Against Torture to send people back to certain torture or death.
I'm not sure that I would characterize the government's efforts in that way in this case, on this record. The record does indicate that the government has really stepped up its efforts. They've arrested 2,400 suspected members. The government is making an effort to intervene, but it's a violent criminal organization. And again,
he's afraid, actually, this is the other half of his case. They may identify him as a Mungiki. The board notes that thousands of Mungiki have been summarily shot by police death squads. So not bothering to ask, you know, are you still an adherent to the Mungiki or whatever, just boom, shot on sight. So that's actually a comparable risk that he faces.
But
and
in
that's
this,
definitely government action, no question about that.
Correct. But in this case, while he was active, he had no run-ins with the police. The police never questioned him and never targeted him and never harmed him.
Thanks to these proceedings, they're going to know the link.
But the evidence doesn't compel the conclusion that the police would target him where they did not target him when he was in fact an active member.
How do we know how carefully, when they were summarily executing people, they checked to make sure they were shooting the right person?
Well, we don't, but we do know that the record indicates that they were targeting people who were involved in criminal activity, and the petitioner in this case says that he's not planning to be involved in criminal activity or have any further interactions with the Mungiki, and we know that he did not have problems with the police when he was active, so it stands to reason by the immigration judge, from the immigration judge's decision, that he has not met the burden that it's more likely than not that he will now be targeted.
If I could just ask one other question, Ms. Carmichael.
Yes, sir.
Can you help remind me what the immigration judge said about this evidence that Mr. Wanjiru would probably have to move, if he was removed back to Kenya, would have to go back to the same area where he was from, where there's a lot of Munkiki there because of living patterns, geographic patterns within Kenya.
Well, he testified that in Kenya they live by tribe,
right.
And so he would need to move back to where his tribe was.
Was that taken into account by the immigration judge, as you read the opinion?
I'm not sure, actually, whether
Neither
the immigration judge specifically considered that, but the immigration judge did consider the record as a whole.
I'm not sure either, because, and it seems awfully important in terms of trying to evaluate the odds for Mr. Wanjiru if he's required to return to Kenya. So.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carmichael. Ms. Marashko.
A couple of quick points, Your Honor. Judge Hamilton, the immigration judge does not use that part in his reasoning, so he does not say, I recognize that he has to return to the area that is a stronghold of the Mungiki. And I think the reason
he... have to, or is that just a cultural force?
They live according to the tribes. So
I
understand
that. Do the Kikuyu have a different language, for example?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Following up on Judge Flom's point... Is there a linguistic difference or any other distinguishing factor for the Kikuyu group as opposed to the other groups in Kenya?
I don't know the answer to the question, Your Honor. Judge, would you, just to point you to the page where the quote, like I knew their names but I didn't want to specify, that's on 499 of the record.
Okay.
And the last point that I have on the governmental acquiescence, it's important to see what the immigration judge said too, in addition to what the board said. The immigration judge said, I see that there's allegation of some connection between the government and the Mungiki, but there's no corroboration. What he is doing is he is requiring something much more than willful blindness. And that's especially clear from one of the reports that the immigration judge actually cites. I see that.
You may complete your thought.
One of the reports that the immigration judge actually cites, which notes that the police and the government have been turning a blind eye towards this problem.
So is your position that in this case, the Kenyan government is complicit with the Mungiki?
Yes. In fact, this court said as much in Gatimi. There is compelling evidence that the Kenyan government is complicit in the Mungiki violence.
At least parts of the government.
Exactly. He is caught between the rock and the hard place.
Between different factions within the government.
Right. Parts of it want to go after him, unsuspecting him to be a Mungiki.
Squads.
Right. And parts of them want to go after, are failing to prevent the Mungiki from going after him.
Okay. Thank you. All right, thanks to both counsel, all counsel. And Ms. Marashko, was your firm appointed on this case?
Yes, my colleague Brad Murray was.
All right. Well, you, in addition to, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing the petitioner.